This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for November 4th, 2013. It was an interesting week. The IRS is back in action. The courts are back in action. So we start with letter rulings. Upfront incentive payments paid by a utility company to assist its customers in acquiring equipment to produce on-site electricity in order to comply with state rules and regulations are currently deductible. A small insurance company's exempt status was revoked for failure to pay attention to the rules. 6. S-corporation elections that were inadvertently terminated because stock was transferred to trusts which were not electing small business trusts have been given an opportunity to straighten themselves out and keep their S election. The October status of the Treasury Inspector General's Tax Administration for Tax Administration's recommended actions for the IRS Exempt Organizations Division to clean itself up, we are reported last week. And then a very interesting case, Kathleen Simpson, in which the tax court parses a discrimination settlement award, finding that a small portion of it was in fact excludable under Code Section 104. Terry Ellis attempted to use his IRA to fund a business and failed to follow the rules precisely and exactly, and has about a $350,000 taxable income plus a prohibited transaction and penalties. Inflation adjusted tables are out for 2014. A couple of those things might be interesting. And then the 2014 PTIN renewal period is open as of October 31st, 2013. And the IRS is encouraging all of us, of course, to renew early. Finally, we have updated frequently asked questions on the net investment tax, the Section 1411 tax, that's causing so much consternation and so much conversation about how to protect our clients from that tax, if in fact we can. So we have a lot to cover. Let's get started. In Letter Ruling 2013-41031, the IRS rules that one-time, upfront payments that an electric utility made as incentives to customers who agreed to buy, install, and maintain eligible systems were currently deductible as ordinary and necessary business expenses and need not be capitalized. The Electric Utility Commission in the subject state adopted rules requiring electric utility companies operating in that state to produce a certain amount of renewable energy each year. Compliance with the renewable energy requirements is measured by renewable energy credits. Under the rules, at least a certain percentage of the renewable energy must come from distributed energy, that is, energy created by equipment owned by the particular utility's customer and located on that customer's premises. As a result, the company was required to implement a plan to comply with the rules and to allocate specific funding for each segment of the plan, including the distributed energy requirement. To meet the distributed energy requirement, the company makes front-end payments to incentivize customers, both residential and commercial, to purchase and install certain generating systems. Those are one-time upfront payments based on the potential energy production and made to a customer who agrees to purchase, install, and maintain the eligible system. There is no refund or partial refund if the upfront initiative is required. No refund or partial refund of the upfront initiative is required so long as the system is maintained and not removed. There is no market for the distributed energy credits in the state or elsewhere. No other utility would want them because they would not be distributed energy credits to the other utility. Neither the company nor any other subsidiary of its parent has ever sold, transferred, or traded a distributed energy renewable energy credit. There is no long-term benefit to the company other than allowing the company to comply with state law. Next, Letter Ruling 2013-41036, in which the IRS revokes the tax-exempt status of an organization whose purpose was the reinsurance of credit insurance contracts, vehicle service contracts, and certain other service contracts. The IRS found that the corporation failed to operate in accordance with the provisions of Section 501(c)(15) which are applicable to small insurance companies. It's important to note that the corporation had never filed an election under Section 831B to pay tax on its investment income when premiums do not exceed $1,200,000. The corporation had a few other problems, which we will enumerate. But first, let's set the stage. Section 206, Clarification of Exemption from Tax for Small Property and Casualty Insurance Companies, which was included in the Pension Funding Equity Act of 2004, amended 501c15a to change the definition of small property and casualty insurance companies exempt from income taxes to 1. A company whose gross receipts for the taxable year do not exceed $600,000 and over half such gross receipts consist of premiums, currently whose net written premiums, or greater if direct written premiums, for the taxable year do not exceed $350,000, or 2. A mutual insurance company whose gross receipts for the taxable year do not exceed $150,000 and more than 35% of which consist of premiums, and B. None of whose employees or member of the employee's family is an employee of another company exempt from tax under Section 501c15. Notice 2006-42, the IRS provided guidance as to the meaning of gross receipts for purposes of Section 501c15a, advising taxpayers that the service will include amounts received from the following sources: premiums, including deposits and assessments without reduction for return premiums, items described in Section 834B, that would be the gross investment income of a non-life insurance company, and other items that are properly included in the taxpayer's gross income. Notice 2006-42 also states that amounts received by all members of the insurance company's controlled group, as that is defined in Code Section 501C15C, are taken into account for purposes of these tests. The definition of controlled group for this purpose is any controlled group of corporations as defined in 1563A, except that you substitute more than 50% for at least 80%. Based on the gross receipts of the organization, which is the subject matter of the ruling, and the gross receipts of other organizations that the director and his wife have a more than 50% ownership in, total gross receipts exceeded the $600,000 limitation. The gross receipts of the other organizations of the controlled group are required to be considered in the computation of gross receipts as of January 1st, 2003. So as of that date, the organization no longer qualified for tax exemption under 501c15. And that really is the end of the story. It's the end of one story, the beginning of another, because the corporation should have been filing Forms 1120 PC, not Forms 990 for all of those years. It's a valuable lesson in there. I think that as tax advisors, we need to keep our wits about us when we're dealing with these special corporate forms. That requirement that you aggregate the gross receipts of all members of a control group is not exactly hidden. It's right there in the same statute that permits the small insurance company to exist as a tax-exempt entity. In any event, we next have a letter ruling 2013-41-019. Termination of an S-corporation election was inadvertent when S-corporation shares were transferred to a trust, and the transferring shareholder was unaware of the requirements for the trust to be a qualified subchapter S trust. Five others had the same issue on the same day, with S-corporation stock being transferred to trusts. In each case, the IRS, for reasons that are not clearly explained in detail, the IRS gave permission to the corporations and to the trusts to correct the failure to make an election and ruled that the S-corporation status would not be adversely affected so long as the trusts made the proper elections and the beneficiaries provided the proper consents. Next, as of October 24, 2013, the Exempt Organization Division has made substantial progress in dealing with the recommendations from the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration to assure that the recent difficulties regarding 501c4 organizations will not be repeated. For those of you that are interested, there is a report with a chart available at www.irs.gov newsroom. It is titled Exempt Organizations Recommended Actions, October 24th, 2013. This involves training, it involves changes to the Internal Revenue Manual, and it involves a requirement that the director of rulings and agreements must have written policies for approval of all original entries and changes to criteria included on any listing for special attention to application for 501c4s. Next, Kathleen Simpson, 141 TC number 10. Here, the court holds that the amount an individual received in settlement of an employment discrimination suit was not excludable from income as paid under Workers' Compensation Act, but a percentage was excludable as received for physical injuries or sickness. The court also allowed Ms. Simpson a deduction as claimed for attorney fees and court costs. Ms. Simpson attributed her depression, irritable bowel syndrome, and fibromyalgia to her work at Sears Roebuck & Company, and requested but did not receive a transfer to another position. She was later terminated and filed suit under the California Fair Employment and Housing Act, claiming employment discrimination and retaliation, as well that Sears failed to provide her a reasonable accommodation and to engage in an interactive process with her. After a state court dismissed two of the claims, Ms. Simpson's attorney claimed she also was entitled to workers' compensation benefits. Eventually, Simpson and Sears settled the suit for $250,000, with $98,000 for emotional distress and physical and mental disability, and $152,000 for attorney fees and court costs. On her joint return filed with her husband, Ms. Simpson did not include any part of the award in her income. The IRS picked up the payment and determined that they should have included the income. The court determined it was not clear that the settlement was paid under a Workers' Compensation Act because the settlement agreement reached with Sears didn't mention workers' compensation claims at all. Further, the party's failure to comply with California state law, which requires approval of a settlement of workers' compensation claims by the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board, barred any exclusion of the settlement from income. Finally, using its best judgment, the court determined that 10% of the $98,000 was paid for physical injuries and sickness, and that amount was excludable from income. Tax Court Judge Laro also went on to conclude that from the evidence provided, Ms. Simpson was in fact entitled to deduct the full amount she claimed for attorney fees and court costs. Those attorney fees and court costs, of course, would be deductible as miscellaneous itemized deductions, not as transaction costs. So she might have some alternative minimum tax issues. You may recall that from time to time in this program I have warned everyone about using IRAs and 401ks to fund businesses, the so-called ROBS transaction or some of its variations. In this decision, Terry Ellis, TC Memo 2013-245, the tax court sustains an accuracy-related penalty, a 10% addition to tax, finding that an individual engaged in a prohibited transaction when he caused a business that was owned by his IRA to pay him compensation, resulting in the account no longer being an IRA and generating a taxable deemed distribution. To give you an idea of how much money is involved, let's review the elements of the total. A deficiency in federal income tax for 2005 of $135,936 and an accuracy penalty of $27,187. Mr. Ellis tried a fairly common scheme. He rolled money out of his 401k into an IRA, caused his IRA to buy an interest in a company that had no other shareholders and therefore had no concerns about determination of value, and so far he's okay. But like all of these, the problem comes in the operation of the business. When Mr. Ellis caused the business to pay him a salary, that was not a payment in his capacity as a fiduciary managing the IRA's money. It was in fact a personal benefit from the business owned by the IRA. It was a distribution. And you can review a list at section 4975C that defines what is a prohibited transaction for this purpose. The error that was not understanding the difference between a payment that might have been made to Mr. Ellis as a manager of the IRA's assets and a payment of the IRA's assets to him for some other purpose. They argued that he did not engage in a prohibited transaction when he caused the entity in which the IRA had invested to pay him compensation because it was not plan income or assets of the IRA. But the court explained that it was, as earnings of a company owned by the IRA, the payments to Mr. Ellis were in fact assets of the IRA. They went on then to argue that the prohibited transaction rule does not apply to the receipt by a disqualified person of reasonable compensation for services rendered or for the reimbursement of expenses properly and actually incurred in the performance of his duties with the plan. But Mr. Ellis's duties were not with the plan. They were with the company in which the plan had invested, and the scheme failed. The problem with these plans, with these schemes, is they work perfectly on paper, but they don't work perfectly in operation because there seems always to be a foot fault. And all the IRS needs here is a foot fault. Next, we have Revenue Procedure 2013-35, the inflation-adjusted tables for 2014. 43 different amounts are adjusted for inflation. The 2014 standard deduction increases to $12,400 for married couples filing jointly. The personal exemption rises to $3,950. That's a $50 increase. The maximum earned income credit amount for 2014 will be $6,143. The foreign earned income exclusion, $99,200, and the amount of estate valuation, which is excluded from taxation, will be $5,340,000. If you're interested in the entire list, it's Revenue Procedure 2013-35. Next, the PTIN renewal period is open. Information Release 2013-85 explains some changes that are made in the PTIN program, but reminds us that we all have to renew and encourages us to renew early. Next and finally, an updated frequently asked question list on the net investment income tax, the Section 1411 tax, which is causing so much grief and consternation. A reminder that estates and trusts will be subject to that net investment income tax when their taxable income exceeds $11,650. Well, I'm sorry, adjusted gross income. Now, individuals are subject to that, married filing jointly, when adjusted gross income exceeds $250,000. But you hit the Section 1411 tax bracket right away in a trust. If you are including interest, dividends, and capital gains of your children in your 1040 by reason of a Form 8814, those amounts will be included in calculating your net investment income. Gross investment income includes interest, dividends, capital gains, rental and royalty income, non-qualified annuities, income from businesses involved in trading of financial instruments or commodities, and businesses that are passive activities as to the taxpayer. Gains that are included in net investment income include gains from the sale of stocks, bonds, and mutual funds, capital gain distributions from mutual funds, gain from the sale of investment real estate, including gain from the sale of a second home that is not a primary residence, and gain from the sale of a personal residence that exceeds the amount which is excludable in the individual's return, $250,000 in single return, $500,000 in married filing joint. Remember, the net investment income tax is subject to estimated tax provisions, and it is paid with the Form 1040, or in the case of a trust, with the Form 1041. If you want to get a preview of the form that's going to be used to report the net investment income tax, go to www.irs.gov and search for Form 8960. That is the form which will be used to report net investment income. Well, gang, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks for listening and thanks for participating. Remember, stay safe.